from WXXI News. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made on Thursday, November 2nd, when a popular conservative online magazine called The Federalist published a piece about birth control. The piece was written by a certified family physician named Dr. Marguerite Duane. Dr. Duane opened the piece by questioning whether many women even understand what birth control is, a strange way for a medical professional to introduce her argument. And then Dr. Duane wrote about why she believes birth control does not treat health problems very effectively. She primarily relied on her own personal experience, and she ignored mountains of evidence, along with millions of personal anecdotes from women who use birth control to treat various issues. The doctor also wrote that she advises women to track their periods in order to medically treat certain issues. That has a familiar ring to it, as many evangelicals support the same kind of approach to prevent pregnancy. It's referred to as natural family planning or the rhythm method, and studies show it doesn't work nearly as well as other forms of birth control. Now, the piece in The Federalist sparked a number of responses from the medical community across the country. Perhaps the most cited was written by Dr. Jen Gunther, an OBGYN who's become a prominent voice on social media and other platforms. This hour, we invited Dr. Gunther to join us, along with local doctors, to discuss birth control as medication and the benefits of birth control the science of it. It's also a chance for listeners to share their stories. If you'd like to do that, you can, and have your questions answered this hour. My guests include on the line with us Dr. Jen Gunther, one of the most prominent OBGYNs in the country, also a pain medicine physician and an author. Dr. Gunther, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
And Dr. Tara Galosh is here. She's chief of medicine at the United Memorial Medical Center. Tara, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for the opportunity to be here.
And very good. And Dr. Sarah Bastad is here. She is Associate Professor of Obstetrics and Gynecology at the University of Rochester Medical Center. And after all of that, did I mistake your last name, Sarah?
It is Bastad, but it was a good try.
There's three T's in there. Dr. Sarah Bastad's here. Thank you, Doctor. It's great to have you here. Dr. Gunther, I'm going to start with you. I know your time is a little limited on the panel today. So let me just start by asking you, here in 2017, are you surprised to see someone who is, this is not a conservative columnist, this is a certified physician writing a piece titled Stop Denying Science, Birth Control Isn't Necessary for Women's Health. That surprised you, Dr. Gunther?
Well, I guess it's sad that it didn't surprise me, actually, because these types of pieces and this opinion, these types of opinions, incorrect opinions, have been floating around for quite a while. You know, I did my fellowship and in Kansas, and I practiced in Kansas for 6 years, and so there was certainly these types of conversations amongst some physicians there, and that was, you know, in the 90s. So it's just becoming more prominent and being given more of a voice, I think, now.
Dr. Gunther, you keyed in on a number of issues you saw in the piece in your own response, starting with the fact that you thought it was insulting to many women. You even said it was a misogynistic screed on contraception. Why?
I did, because I think the majority of women really understand what birth control is and how it works. I mean, to think that little of women is just shocking to me. I have many friends who are not physicians, and they full well understand how most methods of birth control work, and that this is not just something to prevent pregnancy, but also to treat many health conditions. So, I mean, that was just really insulting.
And you also keyed on another point that I want to point out to listeners. This is not meant to be a political discussion this hour. It should be about medicine. Medicine and
right.
Science should be outside of politics. But there is a political element to the timing of the piece on The Federalist. And I'll credit longtime lawyer and activist April Rain on Twitter for pointing out the following, that in 2012, the birth control benefit was included in the Affordable Care Act, establishing birth control as preventive health care. And it made birth control and all other preventive health care services copay free. But on October 6th, the Trump administration announced a couple of new rules that would allow any employer, university, or insurer to deny coverage of birth control by citing moral or religious conflicts. So right now, birth control is on the table in the healthcare discussion as is it medically necessary or not. So Dr. Gunther, when you see a piece like this, do you think that it does carry sort of the patina of politics?
Absolutely. It's designed to circulate on Facebook and this is fake news. This is designed to try to change people's opinions. People are going to share it on Facebook, on Twitter. They're going to talk about it. And as we know, the majority of people don't read beyond the headlines, or at least, you know, the first paragraph. People are going to see that headline and they're going to see a doctor's name. And that's wrong and it's damaging.
And Dr. Gunter, you also mentioned in your piece that vulnerable populations are especially at risk when it comes to losing birth control. And again, April Rain on Twitter says that the following, quote, a group at particular risk from current efforts to undo Obamacare, gut Medicaid, and slash domestic programs are women of color. Women of color have long experienced stark health disparities in areas like cervical and breast cancer, unintended pregnancy, and pregnancy-related complications. Is that right, Dr. Gunter?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, any type of restriction of access to birth control will absolutely affect those who are least able to pay for it, which I think is even what makes this piece more insulting. Somebody like Dr. Duane can go out and purchase a prescription. Somebody like me can go out and purchase a prescription. You know, I write these pieces, and I work with my advocacy because there are women who can't, and we have to help them get access to birth control. We have to help them get access to medications that can change their lives.
We're going to be talking about the science as we go throughout the hour, and listeners, if you've got questions or comments on this, you can call the program toll-free. It's 844-295-TALK. It's 844-295-8255. Or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Dr. Galosh, what was your first response to seeing this piece as it circulated?
I think I would really echo what Dr. Gunter just said, that it is very concerning to see a physician coming out and essentially turning their back on all of the medical science that shows the wide variety of health benefits of contraception that go well beyond just preventing unintended pregnancy.
Dr. Betstadt, what stood out to you most from this piece in terms of whether there were any sort of red flags or concerns?
Oh, immediately when I started reading the article, I noticed that, you know, she questioned the mechanism, or she stated that the mechanism of contraception wrong. She said that it was embryocidal. And we know that the mechanism of all contraception is actually to prevent pregnancy. It does not end a pregnancy. So she misquoted the actual mechanism of contraception in the first few sentences of the piece.
Yeah, she used that term embryocidal. Dr. Gunter, you jumped on that as well. Was that a is that a kind of a dog whistle to people who are against any sort of contraception at all? And I ask because I don't know the answer to that. But with Dr. Betstadt and Dr. Gunter both jumping on that, do you view it that way, Dr. Gunter?
Yeah, I mean, it's a fake medical term. I've never used the term embryocidal in my life, and I've been a doctor for 25 years. So, you know, I mean, I think there's that. And it's really a dog whistle to the personhood movement, and this is an attempt to try to weave birth control in with that. And it's frankly incorrect and needs to be called out. And really, it's disgusting to see a physician do something like that.
Dr. Betstadt, you have a few numbers that I think are probably valuable to this discussion, because Dr. Duane in her piece, and again, if you want to see the piece that sparked this discussion on the Federalist, it's titled Stop Denying Science, Birth Control Isn't Necessary for Women's Health. It is written by a licensed physician, a certified physician, but it goes against the mountain of science that is out there. That's why we're talking about it right now. And Dr. Betstadt, before the program began, we just talked a little bit about the fact that you have Dr. Duane in her piece saying, you know, and with her own issues, she tracked her periods to better treat and better know when to take, I think ibuprofen, those kind of things, as opposed to birth control. And that, to me, sort of was also kind of a close cousin of the discussion on family planning, or what they call the rhythm method, tracking your periods to prevent pregnancy without using birth control. And I think you mentioned before the hour began that for those who choose that, you know, that's certainly a choice they can make, but it is not as effective. Is that correct?
Correct. When we look at contraceptive efficacy, we have a wide variety of methods. And those methods that require the least input from the patient using them, such as long-acting reversible contraception, where it's something implanted in the body, those are highly affected methods because there's very little user error. But with something like the user, with something as like the rhythm method, typical use failure rates, meaning the average person using these methods, have up to a 24% chance of having a pregnancy at the end of the year if they use that method as their contraceptive method, just because it requires diligently tracking your period, paying attention to symptoms such as cervical mucus, which can be extremely difficult. So of all the contraceptive options, the rhythm method is actually one of the least effective contraceptive methods and the most difficult to use.
Okay, and so again, that's not to condemn anyone who wants to use that or feels like that's the right choice for them. But if you then link it to medicine, if you then link it to birth control for medical purposes, and then say, well, do it the same kind of way, just track your periods and try to treat with different pain medication, et cetera, are there also potential pitfalls you see there?
I'm sorry, can you say that again?
If you're trying to track your periods in the same way that you would to prevent pregnancy, to prevent pain, or instead of saying, well, I'm going to take birth control,
sure,
treat it,
sure,
I'll just do sort of the rhythm method for pain control and those kinds of things. Can you also sort of mistreat in that way?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it actually can be quite difficult for women. It sounds easy. Oh, just track your periods, follow your periods every month. But many women actually have irregular cycles due to polycystic ovarian syndrome. Obesity can also cause changes in ovulation so that your periods are not regular. So for many women, simply saying just track your periods to prevent pain, that's not even an option for them.
Okay. And Dr. Galasha, before we get into some of the specifics on the science of it, what's the broader view that you have when you have, if you've got patients who say, well, birth control, you know, carries the name birth control in the same way that the iPhone is a phone, but it does a lot more than just act as a phone. Birth control is there for many other medical reasons. For those who doubt that, what's the first answer you give them as to whether it does have efficacy medically for a wide range of conditions?
Well, we know that actually up to about 30% of women are going to present to their doctor at some point in time complaining of heavy menstrual cycles. So, and our most common way to treat that is to use some type of birth control method. Birth control pills can reduce bleeding by 40 to 50%. Methods like Dr. Bedstat was bringing up, the IUDs, the LARC methods, can actually reduce bleeding by up to 97%. And so considering that a third of women have this complaint, I think clearly we see a need for contraceptive methods outside of just birth control.
Dr. Gunter, I know you only got a few more minutes, so let me ask you then to kind of direct us to what you think is kind of, it shouldn't be a game, but sort of the game right now in terms of politics. What do you see happening on the national level, and what is your sort of chief concern, not just with a piece like this, but with the discussion about birth control as a medical option for women?
Well, I think the government should get out of healthcare in the sense of telling people how or what medication to use and how it works. The government has no place in exam rooms, and, you know, forcing beliefs or allowing insurers to say, well, I don't believe that that's how an IUD works, so we can opt out of it. That's just unacceptable. So I think that we have to fight for science, which then leads us also to fight for women, because women are the ones who are going to be most victimized by this. All of this sort of government intrusion into how medications should be prescribed or what happens in the exam room only happens, for women of reproductive age and reproductive potential. So I think it is very important that we say that this is a Maginot line and we are not going to let it be pushed back, that we have to push forwards. And that's why I believe in responding to these pieces immediately and trying to shut them down before they circulate and sort of put a wedge in people's mind about, maybe the science isn't correct.
In our second half hour, we'll take some listener responses to these issues, and we've gotten a lot this morning. And I know, Dr. Gunter, you've had no shortage of response in various platforms on your website, the piece that you wrote on Twitter. But I guess I want to ask you, as someone who communicates the science of medicine, I think, extremely well, you still run into a lot of Dunning-Kruger effect, a lot of so-called experts who are not actual experts, a lot of men who want to tell you that you're wrong. And I wonder if you see anything working in this. In other words, when you write these kinds of pieces, whether it's on Gwyneth Paltrow's bizarre jade eggs or, it's on birth control as science, do you generally fear that you're kind of preaching to a choir and you're not breaking through, or have you seen any breakthrough?
I do, it's true, obviously, that the large part of my readership are people that believe like I do. But you know what? Those people share my pieces on social media with other people. And I get messages, back all the time about how I've changed people's views or made them think differently. And the piece that I think resonated most, I wrote a piece a year or two ago about sex selective abortion. And I have had more people, more professionals, more journalists, more physicians, and also, just everyday people who follow me reach out to me and say, my gosh, that piece changed my mind. That changed my opinion. So, you know, my view is the more people who want to listen to me, maybe the more people will listen to some of the other things that I write about, and that will help change their mind or make them think a little differently about it. And I'll just put in a plug for that piece on sex selective abortion. You know, people always talk about that, but they don't talk about the woman who's had 12 girls and is back again pregnant with her 13th because the only thing that she can do to stop having a baby is to produce a boy. We never talk about that woman.
Hmm. Dr. Gunter, last question then before I let you go then. It's one thing, I think, to get those people, you're right, in the general population who say, this piece changed me, or this is a different way of viewing things. And I'm sure you feel like a lot of people feel, one at a time, you know, with that, to get science sort of in the door and understood. What about government? Has anything changed your view over the course of your career that government is less ideological, or does it feel more ideological these days?
Well, it feels a lot more ideological since November. You know, I think that we are seeing a dangerous trend of religious overtones intruding into healthcare and science, and that is, of course, the exact opposite. I mean, science is about fact; it's not about belief. And when someone is flying my plane that I'm on, I want them to be flying that plane not with belief, but with facts and science. And when someone's building my car, I want them to build it with facts and science for the safety. And I would hope that we could do the same for medicine, that we would use facts and science to make things as safe as possible to try to help everybody in the best way possible.
Dr. Gunter, where can people find you online?
They can find me online at Twitter. I'm just Dr. Jen Gunter. That's my blog, Dr. Jen Gunter. And that's my Facebook page, Dr. Jen Gunter. I have to make it simple for me.
And I know you speak. I know you speak for yourself as an OBGYN today and in various forms of media. So
yes, I am just representing myself and just trying to get facts out there so people can make the best decisions for themselves with facts.
One of the most prominent voices in the medical community online. Thanks for taking the time for the program today, Dr. Gunter.
Thank you so much for having me.
Dr. Jen Gunter joining us now. Here's what I want to do. I've got a bunch of comments that have come in via Twitter, via email, a lot. And we're going to work through some in terms of questions, some women sharing their own experiences, sharing their family experiences, some questions on the science. So we're going to get to those with our guests in studio, Dr. Tara Galosh, is Chief of Medicine at United Memorial Medical Center, Dr. Sarah Betstadt, Associate Professor of Obstetrics and Gynecology at the University of Rochester Medical Center. They're in studio with us, and after our only break of the hour, which we'll take now, we'll come right back and start with your questions just on the science of birth control. We're here because The Federalist, which is an online conservative magazine, published a piece by a doctor saying, stop denying science, birth control isn't necessary for women's health. But the vast majority of doctors who work in the field say it is. And we're going to talk about why that is after our only break on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, the Trump administration would like to eliminate the federal historic tax credit. And that's a tax credit that helps launch some redevelopment work on historic structures that might be too unwieldy or too far gone otherwise to save. Developers say this would be a big injustice to communities, Rochester and the Finger Lakes included, if the tax credit is slashed. Conservatives say it's too much government spending. We'll discuss it next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. I think in some ways, the women who are sharing their stories with us on various platforms give us a jumping off point of discussion because everyone's had a slightly different experience or different reasons for using birth control as medicine. And I'm going to work through some of them with our guests. We're also going to work through some of the questions you've had. And Jen on Twitter says, first of all, she's she's quoting what I said earlier when I said birth control is a medical, not a political issue. And she writes, yes, a little louder for the people in the back, please. And then Jen goes on to say she just put her 18-year-old daughter on birth control for the same crippling cramps that she had. It's preventative medicine. It's endangered her health and safety otherwise without it. So let me ask, and I'll start with Dr. Sarah Betstadt. When you hear Jen say, you know, she's got an 18-year-old daughter, crippling cramps, and that this has been effective for her, how does that work, and how often do you hear that? That's pretty common.
Sure, that's very common. That's definitely one of the many non-contraceptive benefits of contraception is that it makes periods lighter, less painful, shorter. Dr. Galosh mentioned that it, you know, reduces bleeding by 50%. So yes, we hear that all the time, and that's one of the most common indications that women use birth control pills.
Okay, and Dr. Galosh, thoughts on what Jen had to say there about her daughter?
No, I mean, I think that's exactly right. I mean, we know that just using a birth control pill can reduce that pain, and we know we actually have options to make the period stop. We can choose to be amenorrheic or to not have periods, either through the use of pills or through some of the longer acting methods.
Listeners, it's 844-295-TALK. If you want to weigh in with your comments or questions, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Jane emails the program to say, I've had extremely heavy and painful cycles for years to the point that I have taken time off work because of it. My gynecologist recommended I try birth control, but I haven't due to all the side effects such as weight gain, risk of blood clots, stroke, etc. Those side effects don't seem worth it, even at a low dose. So instead, I endure the pain and bleeding. I'll start with Dr. Galosh on that. What do you think?
Well, certainly birth control pills can carry some risks, and I think it's really important that this is a discussion with a medical provider looking at what other risk factors a woman has. You know, are we dealing with obesity? Are we a smoker or a diabetic? And there are definitely a wide variety of options that are available. It's not all just birth control pills that contain estrogen. And there are many other methods that may actually be very effective for her, whether it includes using a progestin-only option, which has a lower risk of strokes and blood clots, or whether it's using a progestin IUD, which would, again, reduce that risk of strokes.
And I just wanted to chime in that contraception typically gets a bad reputation that causes these bad side effects. But actually, when you put contraception in perspective from some of the risks of pregnancy, you're much more likely to, for example, have a blood clot in pregnancy. So you're much more hypercoagulable in pregnancy than on a birth control pill. Hypercoagulable means, you know, your risk of getting a blood clot is higher in pregnancy. So some of the myths that are surrounding contraception really, I think, could be quelled by saying that a lot of these quote-unquote side effects are actually more likely to happen to you in pregnancy than when you're taking hormonal contraception.
Okay. Here is an email from Joy in Rochester. She's responding directly to Dr. Marguerite Duane's piece in The Federalist, in which Dr. Duane did refer to her own medical problems and her decisions not to take birth control because, well, I don't know. Let me ask the doctors here. What can you just share your thoughts on the anecdote she shared about her personal experience and your sort of, and Dr. Galosh, you want to start?
Yeah. I mean, It is very questionable to base decisions on a population level based on the story of one person. And I think that's Dr. Duane's mistake in this case. Certainly, you know, the treatment that she chose to use for her own painful cycles, which is using an anti-inflammatory, an NSAID, ibuprofen, along with tracking her cycles, is a very effective way of reducing painful periods. But it does not work for everybody. And not everyone can take ibuprofen or other anti-inflammatory products. So I think we have to really look at that story with a grain of salt, with some skepticism.
Dr. Bestad?
Yeah, I also noticed, you know, she was talking about that she had a painful condition called endometriosis, which certainly the pain can sometimes be worsened by our natural cycling of our hormones every month with our menstrual cycle. And it sounds like she did improve with surgery alone, but actually there's lots of evidence in the literature to suggest that after having a surgical procedure to correct some of the endometriosis, to remove the endometriosis, there's actually more benefit in pain following that by treating with hormones that would further suppress the endometriosis from coming back because there is a high rate of recurrence. So some of the things that she said about endometriosis were also incorrect in that piece.
Well, here's the listener's email, and you can respond to what Joy had to say, and then we'll get to your phone calls. So Pat in Rochester, we'll get to your comment. We got a question from Justine and Victor. Phone continuing to ring. But Joy wanted to talk directly about endometriosis. She says, it's complete and utter BS, we'll say. She says, Joy says, that symptoms of endometriosis can be managed by charting one's cycle and taking a painkiller before the pain actually starts. If she knew anything about the disease, she would know that in severe and chronic cases, Painkillers don't work. I know from experience. If she only knew how many days of work I missed because even when I took the painkillers at the slightest twinge of pain, knowing that it gets worse very quickly, the painkillers weren't enough to get me off the couch curled in a ball of pain. Plus, severe endometriosis causes you to be in pain every single day. Taking painkillers every day is not healthy. Your body can get used to them and they lose their effectiveness. I don't know if that's true on the back end of that.
Yeah, I mean, women's experiences with pain from endometriosis can be varied. But certainly, you know, just taking a dose or two of ibuprofen, as Dr. Duane suggests, is definitely not going to be helpful for many women with the disease. And the disease can be quite severe, causing debilitating pain as well as infertility.
Okay. Dr. Galosh, agree?
Oh, absolutely. And I think what she hit upon there is effect on quality of life. So actually affecting one's ability to go to work, to take care of their families, to be able to maintain those, routines of daily life.
All right, let me get back to your phone calls. This is Pat in Rochester. Oh, we lost Pat. Call us back, Pat. She's got a question about birth control as it relates to migraines. But let's go to Samantha in Dansville. Go ahead, Samantha.
Hi there. First of all, hi, Dr. Galosh. You actually performed a procedure on me to get Esher for my my birth control needs, so thank you. Everything's going just fine. The other thing I wanted to really ask is that I'm curious about using long-term birth control and how those implants impact the reproductive system over time. Have there been any correlations between ovarian cancer or other forms of reproductive cancer due to the stoppage of those hormones causing the natural cycle of reproduction?
I think that's a great question, and I think I sort of heard two questions in one there. So there was sort of a question about, implantable birth control, so IUDs, and, the Nexplanon, which is the progesterone implant that goes in the arm, and then also just on the long-term risks of birth control. So in terms of cancer risk in birth control, we do actually see a reduction in the risk of ovarian cancer with the use of birth control. Control pills. And that risk is actually related to the duration of use. So the longer someone is using a birth control pill, we see a further reduction in that risk of ovarian cancer. And that reduction in risk actually goes beyond the use of the birth control pill. And so I believe it's something like a 20% reduction in risk of cancer for every 5 years of oral contraceptive use. We also see a reduction in the risk of endometrial cancer and a reduction in the risk of endometrial precancers like hyperplasia, both with the use of a birth control pill and the use of the implantable device, the progesterone IUD. So we really actually see some beneficial effects of long-term use of birth control. But that's a great question, and I'm really happy to hear that you're happy with your Esher and doing well.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate your answer, and take care.
Yeah, thank you, Samantha. Thanks for the phone call. It's 844-295-TALK. If you want to join the conversation about birth control as health care, as preventive health care, and whether or not it should be covered, and obviously I think what we're hearing from a lot of listeners is the feeling that it provides benefits well beyond just preventing pregnancy, 844-295-TALK. It's 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-999. Anna on Twitter was asking, I think, a similar question to Dr. Galosh, and let me know if we're sort of overlapping, because I heard you mention at least endometrial cancer. She's asking about potential links between the pill and breast cancer.
So I think I may let Sarah take this question.
Sure.
I mean,
yeah. Sure. So there is no evidence that the birth control pill does cause breast cancer. And in fact, in women who are diagnosed with breast cancer, who are on the pill, actually those cancers are usually found at earlier stages and less aggressive. And that's probably confounded by the fact that those women are actually getting health care. But even if there is a family history of breast cancer, women can still safely use the birth control pill. It's only if women have a personal history or they've had personal breast cancer that probably other non-hormonal methods may be beneficial, depending on the type of breast cancer.
Right, so again, if you're a breast cancer survivor, if you've had it,
right,
probably don't want to be on the pill. Otherwise,
even if your mother had breast cancer,
even if your mother.
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So that's what the medical evidence and the research shows. That's a strong statement. Okay.
And I think one of the things that this brings up is genetic related breast and ovarian cancer syndrome. So women who may actually be a carrier of the breast cancer related gene of BRCA1, BRCA2, these women are also at risk of ovarian cancer. And so being on a birth control pill actually can be protective against ovarian cancer for these women. Ultimately, you know, they may be faced with a choice of having their ovaries removed once they've completed their families, and the birth control pill may provide them some protection before that time.
Okay. Anne in Rochester next on the phone. Go ahead, Anne.
Hi. I just have a quick question about if there's a family history of clotting disorders, do you recommend that those patients be tested for hereditary clotting issues? I've had a number of relatives who have had formed clots on the pill and had to be removed from, you know, taking oral contraception for medical reasons and told not to take it again. So can you speak to that? I don't think doing testing about clotting disorders is routinely done before someone goes on the pill. How do you counsel patients about that?
Sure, I can answer that question. That's a great question. And in general, when there does seem to be a family pattern of blood clots, I think in general it's a great idea that family members do be tested, because certainly a lot of those blood clotting disorders are genetically linked. However, there is evidence to suggest that in general those disorders are very rare. So you don't necessarily need to have established or negative testing prior to starting someone on hormonal contraception. And some of that comes back to what I mentioned before, that you are more likely to have blood clots in pregnancy. So if that patient were, you know, with the patient with the strong family history were to get pregnant, if she carried that gene, she would be much more likely to have a blood clot in pregnancy than, you know, even if she was a gene carrier just taking the birth control pill. So, you know, if that's the, you know, everything has to be personalized. So I would certainly counsel the patient that maybe we would want to use a progestin-only method rather than something with estrogen because of that family history. But if she was dead set on the only method she wanted to use to prevent unintended pregnancy was an oral contraceptive pill, which has estrogen and progesterone, I would certainly let her use that prior to having the testing, and then certainly encourage her to follow up to have that testing for the inherited clotting disorders.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, there's just anecdotal things that I've heard from friends and this one relative who had a young woman, you know, wanted to go on the pill, was adamant about it for acne, another for just, you know, terrible periods, and in two instances developed brain clots, you know, that were, I mean, they just think about, oh, the pill, no big deal, but it is a medication, and they, both of these young women, had basically strokes that were caught very early.
Right, and so, that's definitely
very unfortunate. But is, you know, I think we do forget that it is a medication, and we need to be counseled about it. So thanks for your answer.
I think that's a really great point that you're bringing up, and I think it brings it back to having a conversation with a medical provider and really reviewing in detail, you know, personal history and family history when making these different choices. Because I absolutely agree with Dr. Bedstadt that, you know, with a patient with, you know, who has a family history of clotting, you know, I would encourage them to see a hematologist, and I might steer them towards a progestin-only option when we were unsure if there is a genetic disorder or not within the family.
Pat in Rochester had called to talk about using birth control to help with migraines. Is there a medical track record on birth control and migraine?
So that's actually a complicated question. So there's many different types of migraines, and certainly there are some menstrual migraines, which are actually related to just before the onset of bleeding with menses, the estrogen levels tend to drop, and they think that's what triggers some women to get migraines. So for those specific women, suppressing their natural menstrual cycles would certainly help prevent their migraines. But for some women that have migraines that may be unrelated to the timing of their cycles or unrelated to their cycles, actually taking estrogen-containing contraception can increase their risk of stroke. And those are particularly women with migraines with aura, which are typically visual changes preceding the headache. So, you know, it would really depend on what kind of migraines the patient was having and depending on when they were presenting with those symptoms related to their cycles, whether or not pills may be actually helpful or maybe not the best choice for them. And oftentimes, because headaches themselves can be very complicated, we often enlist the help of our neurology friends to help diagnose the type of headache.
As someone who suffers migraines with aura, Pat, I would just say, you know, it's amazing to me here in 2017 that we haven't licked this problem entirely, that there's still a lot we don't know. But it is interesting to see that there is potentially a difference between migraine with aura and migraine without aura. Mm-hmm.
Certainly in terms of, you know, stroke risk for women, that's the case.
Mm. Pat, thanks for that. Here's an email from a listener named Mark. And, well, again, we said we weren't going to get too political, but I will ask our guest the question. He wants to know, what are your guest thoughts on men making policy on this subject area? Dr. Kalash?
I don't think being a male makes someone unqualified to make policy, but I do...
On women's health care.
On women's health care. I do think that it certainly means that there should be an increased openness about recognizing that we may, you know, if you are not a woman dealing with life as a woman, it may be difficult for you to have a full comprehensive understanding of the situation. And so I would encourage our male political leaders to really do their research and do their homework and talk to women and talk to scientists before really thinking about policy. But I don't think being a male makes them unqualified. I mean,
I just want a second. I think what Dr. Gunther had said that, you know, unfortunately, we have to have policy surrounding women's health decisions. And frankly, a woman's health decision should be between herself and her doctor. And I think it's unfortunate that we have to have policy sort of interfering in those decisions.
Now, I am curious to know if you think the piece that was written for The Federalist, again, by a certified family doctor, arguing that birth control is not necessary for women's health, Dr. Galash, do you worry that that potentially provides some sort of cover for often men in policymaking circles who maybe don't understand the science, and they could point to that and say, well, that was the doctor.
Right.
We should remove birth control as preventative medicine in the next iteration of healthcare reform.
Absolutely. I mean, I think this type of, you know, Dr. Gunter called it out, fake news, is extremely dangerous for exactly those types of reasons. It can be cited by policymakers as proof that, you know, that all these other scientific studies that these are wrong, or that there is some debate among the medical community. I think that that's what, you know, this article is suggesting, is that there's some debate about what contraceptive can provide for women in terms of health care beyond just birth control. And there is no debate in the scientific community about this. These are well-established facts. And so absolutely, I think that this is a dangerous fake news article.
Okay. Dr. Betstan?
No, I agree with that. I mean, we know that family planning is good preventative public health. Every dollar spent in family planning saves up to $6 in other health care costs. We know that women being able to control their fertility leads to better outcomes for families, better health for families, better ability for women to get high-quality jobs to support their families. So there's lots of literature to support that, you know, family planning is good preventative public health.
So the tougher question, and again, I don't want to put our guests in an uncomfortable position, but considering that a month ago the Trump administration announced rules that would allow any employer, university, or insurer to deny coverage of birth control by citing moral conflicts, are there valid moral conflicts that would, if you were an employer, to say, I'm not going to cover your birth control? Is there a valid moral conflict there?
It's very difficult for me to see a valid moral conflict. I mean, given the, you know, we've touched on only a fraction of the other health benefits that contraception can provide to women, you know, in our discussion today. So it's very difficult to see a moral argument against the use of contraception. And, you know, Dr. Bedstadt was touching on, you know, the social impacts as well. You know, we know that women who experience unintended pregnancies are going to have, you know, higher risks of domestic violence, higher risks of financial instability. And so certainly there's a public health benefit as well.
I mean, and my policy with my problem with those types of policies from the Trump administration is that you're allowing companies, fine, the company can say we're going to opt out of, you know, covering contraceptive coverage for our employees, but then, you know, by default, it is making letting other people make those decisions for their employees who may not share those values. And that's not right, in my opinion.
All right, I'm going to read an email that relates to this. As I turn to our listeners again, we got about 10 minutes left. What do you think about covering birth control and the possibility of denying coverage of birth control? How could that impact you or perhaps someone in your family? 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester. 263-9994. Liz writes to the program and says, Evan, I believe this is about shaming of women for being sexually active. When you use the words birth control, a lot of people of certain persuasions, will not believe that it has any other medical reason. But let's be honest, we haven't talked about preventing pregnancy as a valid reason, and some people still feel shame in that. We have to get beyond the shame. That's the moral reason that people are citing. That has to change. That comes from Liz. Dr. Betstadt, what do you think?
No, I totally agree with that. Like I just mentioned, you know, women being able to control if and when they have families allows them to better their own lives. And I think that there, you know, we've talked about all the non-contraceptive benefits of birth control, but there's also just plain old benefits of being able to control your fertility. So I agree.
Okay. Dr. Galosh?
No, I would echo that. I mean, we absolutely know that women who experience, you know, there's over 3 million unintended pregnancies that happen in the U.S. each year. And unfortunately, a third of them result in pregnancy termination. You know, the best, and that is not an outcome that anybody is looking for. And we know the best way that we can, you know, reduce the impact on families and on women is to provide free and universal access to contraception.
Joel writes to the program and says, we've always been willing to pay for erectile dysfunction medication, but not always for birth control pills. That's ridiculous. Is that a fair comparison?
It is.
Yes. Dr. Galash, yes.
It's something that comes up in my office frequently.
Does it really?
Absolutely. And you know, as a corollary, a little off topic, but there's some treatments for, you know, menopausal symptoms, vaginal dryness, that type of thing, that are also not covered by insurance for women and have a great deal to do with how they're able to maintain their sexual activity after menopause. And that's not a covered benefit by many insurance plans, although the erectile medications are. So it's a challenge.
Well, Dr. Galosh mentioned that we've, you know, haven't even gotten to all of the benefits. Let's for a moment, just let's listen to some more of the benefits that maybe we haven't talked about, because roughly half of our listening audience right now are men. And this is obviously not my area of expertise. My goal is just to listen and to try to understand the possible benefits as well. So you said we haven't gotten through all of them. We probably can't get through all of them in detail, but what are some of the other benefits we haven't talked about?
Well, we know that oral contraceptives can help reduce acne and hirsutism, which is, you know, facial hair growth or hair in other parts of the body where it is not desired. And birth control pills can reduce androgen levels and help those problems significantly for women. We know that for some women, it can be part of effective treatment of premenstrual dysphoric disorder. So that's significant mood-related issues that can make it difficult for them to maintain relationships and to, you know, go through their daily lives. So we can see a significant improvement with that. I don't know if you have anything else to add, Sarah.
I think women who use oral contraception also have a decrease in fibrocystic changes in their breasts. So benign, we've talked already about breast cancer, but this is benign changes in the breast. And it also oral contraception or hormonal contraception can also decrease the incidence of pelvic inflammatory disease in women who... which is an infectious process, and it's by thickening the cervical mucus.
Mm-hmm. Mm. And we mentioned endometriosis, but there's also a condition called adenomyosis, which is another condition that can cause painful, heavy periods, and we'll see often a reduction in symptoms from adenomyosis with the use of a variety of methods of contraception.
Jill wants to know, when is too early to start someone on birth control?
Well, from a family planning perspective and a pregnancy prevention
perspective,
it's never too early. About 70% of kids leave high school sexually active. So I think, you know, thinking, oh, well, we'll wait till they go away to college. You know, the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology, or ACOG, they actually recommend the first visit for adolescents to the gynecologist at age 13, and not necessarily for an exam, but to talk about sexuality, to talk about HPV vaccination, and to certainly introduce the topic of contraception and pregnancy prevention, because as Dr. Galash said, you know, half of all pregnancies in this country are unintended. And I think probably we both have seen patients who are actually already sexually active by age 13. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think it's never too early to start having that conversation. And I think it's really important to be collaborative with our pediatrician partners also to start, you know, even addressing mm-hmm. topics about family planning earlier.
I encourage, you know, oftentimes I'll see the moms of, you know, young teenage women, you know, girls, and they'll ask that same sort of question. And usually I'll say, you know, hey, if you have any concerns, you know, just have them come in for a conversation, because Dr. Bedstadt's correct. We do not need to do an invasive physical exam. We can have a conversation. We can do some screening. And really just starting to open up the conversation with the young woman so that she is comfortable, so that as her contraceptive needs change or as issues with her menstrual cycle potentially arise, that she knows where she can go for care and she's aware of what some of those options are.
Dawn says online on Twitter, sex without fear of getting pregnant equals more and better sex. And again, sort of just another vote for the, we can also talk about just preventing pregnancy as a benefit of contraception. I also, you know, I can't help but think about the conversations we've had about comprehensive sex education in this country compared to other places where they start early. And when I say start early, I'm talking about 4 and 5 years old. And I'm not talking about sex. I'm mm-hmm. talking about what a healthy relationship is, mm-hmm. what respect is, what building those relationships are. Because by the time, if you've got a 13-year-old patient who's either pregnant or sexually active or those kinds of things, often I would guess that there maybe hasn't been really sort of open and honest and adult conversation. We let kids have these conversations. We don't have mature conversations. We don't trust them to be mature and learn. I don't mean to at all to sort of get on a soapbox, but I just can't. When I hear you both describe having young patients, it's just kind of where my mind goes. What do you think, Dr. Bosch?
Well, I mean, I think it's very uncomfortable. I mean, I have a 12-year-old daughter myself, and it's not an easy conversation. She does not want to talk about such things. And so I absolutely sympathize with this desire to sort of put our head in the sand as parents. But I think as a parent, it is our job to protect our children and to protect them even from themselves. And so we do need to have that open dialogue and that open conversation so that we can meet their needs as they change and evolve.
Okay. Dr. Bedstadt?
Yeah. And I just picked up on what you said about education. You know, our government funds abstinence-only education, which in the literature has been shown that it doesn't work. In fact, when teenagers who are, or kids who are a product of that, first have intercourse, they're less likely to use contraception or condoms as a product of abstinence-only education. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, there's a real dichotomy in this country of everything in the media, on television. It's there's a lot of sexuality, people having sex, but yet we can't educate in our schools how to have sex safely and responsibly.
And just to kind of just bolster with a little bit of statistical information, I think the 10 states with the highest rates of unintended pregnancy are almost all contiguously in the American South, which happens to be where there's a lot more abstinence-only education. Mm-hmm. So the highest
Correct.
Levels of abstinence-only education are monolithically right there at the highest levels of unintended pregnancy. I want to thank our guests for being here. We've had a lot of great information for our listeners and, you know, frankly, a lot of important conversation, because right now we're having a national conversation. It's coming back up in the healthcare conversation, whether birth control should be covered medically and is it considered medically necessary for women. And we're trying to trust the science and understand what the experts say on this. So I want to thank our guests for being here. Dr. Tara Galash is Chief of Medicine at United Memorial Medical Center. Doctor, thank you for being here.
Thank you so much.
And Dr. Sarah Bedstadt, Associate Professor of Obstetrics and Gynecology at the University of Rochester Medical Center. Dr. Bedstadt, thank you for your expertise this hour.
Thanks for having me.
Our thanks to Dr. Jen Gunter earlier this hour as well, and for all of the great feedback and comments and questions we had. Short break, more connections coming up.